So I would like to be able to have an opportunity to introduce Dr. Willie Pearson to my left and Dr. Lisa Frahill to my right. And they are the rapporteurs on the report along with myself. And we have some other colleagues in this room who have very much worked on this project. But I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Frahill to start the conversation and give you a little background. All of you have copies of the report. And this is an opportunity just to present some information and to get a discussion going.
Thank you, Kitty. And I think I'm going to try to keep my remarks brief. That will be a miracle. So somebody just throw something at me. Okay. Because we'd really like to be able to get to the point where, you know, there could be a lot of discussion and a lot of questions and so forth from you folks. So the background of this is very interesting. The project actually, Willie Pearson Jr. and other esteemed colleagues, Terry Russell at Association for Institutional Research, Shirley Malcolm, Daryl Chubin, and Cheryl Ligon. And am I leaving anybody out from the original group, Willie? So there's this original group, and they'd gotten together, and they put together this project because there was all this attention being paid to gender issues in science on an international level, but there was not a lot of social scientists engaging with the natural scientists, right, to bring, you know, the two, you know, sort of like, you know, chocolate and peanut butter and bring them together, right? And so, and to get something that's a little bit more robust, you know, than just straight statistics. So they had started working on the project, and it was at the Association for Institutional Research, and by the time that it wove its way through NSF, Terry had actually retired. So then that's when the project actually came to me when I was at the Commission for Professionals in Science and Technology. And then our staff worked on it. We had a workshop in 2009 that had 45 scholars from 10 nations. And we met out at out in Potomac, Maryland, and we all worked in round tables and really started to get the sort of the germ of the project to go. And so the idea was to bring together, like I say, folks who were doing social science with folks in natural science who were deeply committed to these issues in terms of gender in these fields. When it came to me as well, it was just broadly science. Having been a scholar of occupational sex segregation, I knew that we needed to drill down to start to get to some of the details about fields, disciplines, and labor markets that would be really critical to understand, right? Because if you lump everything together, like right now, STEM is this big behemoth category, well, there's a lot of differences within that that get covered up by that aggregation process. So what we did was we chose three disciplines that we thought would be kind of interesting in terms of different labor market structures, different kinds of, so for example, in mathematics and statistics, very different labor market than in, say, computer science, than in, say, chemistry. Different types of educational structures associated with those, as well as different participation of women cross-nationally. So the idea was to have some fields that could start to give us some sense of what are the issues when we start drilling down and looking at specific areas. So we had that first workshop in 2009. The project then moved in late 2010 to the National Academies, and that's when, you know, Kitty started to shepherd it through here, and the second workshop was held here at the National Academies in 2011. And so, again, it was and what you see before you is the actual product of that workshop. So the presentations that had been made, some papers based on those presentations, and some framing. So that's where that's the long road to what you now see in your hands at this point. There's a lot of collaborators on this project, and even some that aren't listed here. It was very logistically difficult from a number of standpoints because it's very easy to do a project in the United States and have it very U.S.-centric. And we truly wanted this to incorporate more voices from the rest of the world to try to understand these international dimensions a little bit better. And so hence we have some international partners, and Kitty was very instrumental in bringing some more international partners to the table with this as well. So, like I say, the idea was to have these global perspectives. We used a lot of OECD data, NSF's data, as much as we could get our hands on. And the idea was there's a lot of gaps in the data. And you'll see that when you look at the report. And those really suggest areas for future research. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Kitty now to talk about the data. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. I think I'm going to sit here just because I want this to be a conversation about the data. A lot of it's in the report. One of the things you're going to see and one of the challenges I think that Lisa alluded to is that when you look at something globally, even with the wonderful team that had worked on this project a lot, you have different categories. So what do you mean by computer science? What type of work is considered a computing work that may be the pipeline that educationally is going through? If you look at mathematics and statistics, you have challenges there in terms of some places that are very distinct in different fields in terms of training. Chemistry, in many of the places where we went to look for data, it's lumped into physical sciences. So you're going to see one of the challenges you're going to come through is you're going to say, well, there's absence of data, and that's one of the issues, or there's an absence of ability to actually talk across the data. But we will share with you some data that I have to say that our colleagues at OECD were very kind to give us full access to all of their data, which was a little overwhelming at times, but gave us some opportunity to look. So you can see on the screen now, here's a, and again, these charts are all in the book, the report, but you can get a sense of that there's some very distinct differences in countries in terms of tertiary degrees in computing in 2008. And the United States is, I would say, probably in a little bit below the middle. What's interesting is that some of these correlate to experiences in other, like engineering and other fields in terms of countries that have a traditional large representation like Turkey or Greece. And others, you will see very distinct differences in terms of computing and other degrees. I think what surprises a lot of people is some of the countries that we see as being very progressive don't necessarily have a lot of women in computing, like Switzerland and other European countries, Germany, where others, like the U.S., one of the issues we've had is actually, until recently, the number of women getting their bachelor's degrees in computing has actually been going down. So this is just giving you one small snapshot, but what you can see immediately, there's a lot of issues and questions that can get raised. Here's mathematics. Again, the United States is highlighted with a little red bar. There's no quiz afterwards, but this is just to give you an idea, again, of the huge variation where you have a country like Estonia, which has 85% of the tertiary degrees in mathematics are going to women. And then you have other countries, again, Switzerland, Denmark, Sweden, who are at the lower half. And the U.S. has actually been doing very well in terms of women at the undergraduate level in mathematics for a while, over 40%. And Willie and Lisa can help me, but I think it's been for at least a couple decades. So, again, you can see that there's some very interesting differences about this in terms of education. Now, the other issue you have to assume is just because you have a large representation of women in the educational degree doesn't necessarily mean that they're in the workforce. And you will again find that there is often a disparity between those who are getting their degrees and those who are in the workforce, where you would expect people with their commensurate education to be represented. Now here's chemistry, just to give you here are three countries. Again, because of the physical sciences, it's very hard to tease out. What strikes me is these are countries that if I went back to the previous graph, which I could go back to, had some differences between mathematics and computer science. But if you look actually in chemistry, look how similar they are in terms of first degree, doctoral degree, and then in the faculty. And obviously, academic career paths are not the only pattern that we're looking in terms of women in these fields, but I think that this does raise some issues in terms of the wisdom of the initial group of Shirley, Willie, Daryl, and Lisa and others to think about how we can look at even some cross-border or cross-globally similarities. Why do we have this lack of representation in particular levels of academia in terms of women? And then this is maybe a little complicated, but this is just to give you a sense. If you look there, physical sciences is yellow, so that's not a complete marker for chemistry. But if you look at, you can see science overall, you can see computing, which is the kind of the light blue, mathematics and statistics is the red triangle, and then the one that's in the if I can, I'm not sure if it'll show right there, that's the United States in the purple, just to give you a sense. But when you look at this, I think what I'm struck by is that going back and echoing something that Lisa said, if you look at science overall, there's a lot of consistently in terms of the gray bars. But then if you actually break down and look at the different disciplines, look at the huge variation. I mean, look at computing in terms of how it's up and down, and then you can actually see that in terms of the physical sciences as well. So I think one of the issues that came out of this workshop summary report is thinking about how aggregation can often hide some of the issues, and then how can you have good policies and programs if you actually don't know your data. So I know that this is a terrible chart. We struggled with how to play. We just really struggled. But don't look at it overall. It's, again, in your book. I think it's like D1 in the appendix. But what you'll see and what's interesting is that when you look then at countries, and you can even look at countries if we were to go back and pull those who had similar numbers in terms of, let's say, having degrees in physical sciences or computing, what you'll find is they're in very different sectors of employment. So if you just even look at countries up there that have business enterprise at this first far left column, look at the differences in numbers. You have some at 2%. You have some that are almost at 20%. And yet you'll see that other countries have much fewer representation of women in sector of employment in terms of higher education and in terms of private nonprofit. And again, I think this raises the issue of workforce, which is, I think, a concern of the committee overall and many of those around this table about what's actually happening to those who achieve those degrees and that knowledge. And then this is because if you notice, which I'm sure you can't see, but if you notice that you will see that the U.S. is not part of this OECD data. And that's beyond our control. So what we did is to supplement it, is we actually put up here, so you can see, this is from NSF data, if you look at the employment sector of women scientists and engineers and occupations as a percent of scientists in the sector, and you'll see that we actually have data that's very different than some of what we would see as maybe countries that have very similar patterns in terms of education production of women in those fields. And so that raises, again, a lot of interesting issues in terms of perceptions, in terms of encouragement, and what's happening in terms of those who get those degrees. And I'm now going to turn it over to Dr. Pearson.
Thank you. I'm just going to highlight the themes. Then I want to get back to how all this started in the first place and then have a quick discussion about kind of next steps. One of the things that became very clear as we went through all the data we were trying to collect of the inconsistencies, not only across countries but also in our own country. And those of you who work in this area know very well that the inconsistencies sometimes involve from one year to the next. Data is not always collected in a systematic way. And sometimes for subpopulations, for example, women of color or people with disability, that's not there at all. So we're just presenting three major themes. There are others. And one had to deal with the criticality of professional societies as a way of establishing a community of scholars and a community of learners and knowledge producers. We found that that made a major impact for women. Another one that you would see is actually building what we call exemplary programs. And these programs varied in terms of targeting the production or the broadened participation of girls and women. Unfortunately, a lot of them were not data-driven. They were not necessarily based upon sound theoretical and methodological principles. And so we have a discussion in the report that deals with that, some of the things that must take place. Some of this work builds on other projects, the BEST project that some of you are aware of. The last one actually had to deal with policy. We wanted to make certain that we had a strong focus on science and technology policy in the report. But we also want to make sure that this particular policy discussion was data-driven. And so as a result of that, we had a very robust discussion at the workshop about connecting all three of these particular themes in a meaningful way. The rest of the discussion is in your book, but I want to return to two pieces. One is the initial group that met with this. This actually grew out of, I guess, a disenchantment of some of us who attended an OECD meeting in Amsterdam. Dr. Wanda Ward, who is here, if you just hold your hand up, was instrumental, along with Barbara Oles, in inviting a number of representatives from the U.S. to attend that meeting. And the meeting dealt with primarily the whole global issue of not producing enough people in general, from K-12 through higher education. And part of that meeting, we were broken into different groups. One group dealt with minorities, and in the case of the OECD meeting, minorities was inclusive of women. Then there were other groups that dealt with kind of disciplinary issues and so forth and so on. Those of us who were involved with the gender portion of that meeting, and I must say that Congresswoman Morella was there, and Daryl Chubin was also present. We pleaded with them to make sure that in the report out, don't separate the women, because gender crossed everything we were talking about in terms of workforce development, in terms of education. Well, sure enough, in the final delivery of the report breakouts, we had about 2 minutes about women, and that was it. We had written up extensive notes about the cross-cutting themes. That led to widespread negative reaction to the guys who were running this. So we decided to caucus. And we could sit there and whine and moan. We could do something else. It was at that point that it became very clear to those persons who were from England, from developing countries, from the U.S., that we need to be proactive in trying to tell this story, because it's not just a women's story. It's an all of us story. And that was being lost. As a result, we had to put together a proposal. And as you know, from when you have different groups, they go away, different things happen. And nothing happened. So some of us have been committed to these issues for a long time. So we did end up putting the proposal together. And fortunately, Carol Stoll, who is here, they found it somewhere, that the proposal had been floating around. The bottom line is that this is critical not only for the U.S., it's a global issue. If we can't do right by women, we won't be able to do right by the rest of us. It'll be a fatal flaw. So from that, this whole project began to evolve. And I want to point out that it's still evolving. This is not the final part of this. The ultimate goal was to produce a book, but also a current website that would be updated periodically on the status of women globally. And part of this issue is that there are still authors who are working on their chapters. So just keep in mind that this is just a summary of the workshop. We still have ongoing work to do. We have to be very vigilant. We have to be good stewards to make sure that the book comes out and that we look at other disciplines besides the three that we've looked at. I think the other thing I just want to mention, that from the outset, we knew that developing human resources would be the best thing we could do. As a result, we included graduate students and others. One of the graduate students from Georgia Tech is here today, Sabrina Atwater, if you hold your hand up, who hopefully will be finishing her PhD very soon. The other person is Lisa Borrello, who is also a PhD student at Georgia Tech and should be finishing within the next year. And we had Wei, who's here at the Academy. The other thing, I just want to thank the other persons. At the time we had our first workshop, Dr. Wanda Ward represented EHR. And that particular support was very vital because we saw a number of young women regardless of race, ethnicity, began to see a woman who was head of a directorate at that particular time. The other person I was just mentioning again, we're grateful to her support, and that's Carol Stoll. If you hold your hand up. It would have been very easy for an NSF program officer to just say, we've done with this. That's not what happened. And I think that we are better because of Carol Stoll and some others who actually supported this initiative. I think I've covered everything that I need to cover. Thank you.
So now we would like to open up the floor and have some conversations, thinking about what Dr. Pearson just mentioned and Dr. Frahill in terms of some of these issues and challenges, thinking of some of the many of you around the table either represent disciplinary studies or federal agencies, thinking about the issues in terms of how we build exemplary programs and policies. We'd love to hear from you because our hope and expectation is that this is an initial step in continuing discussion with many of the colleagues in the room. The only thing I'm going to ask is that you identify yourself because we do have people on the webcast, and that would just make them feel like, you know, they didn't have lunch, but they can be part of the conversation.
Hi, I'm Ann Drobnis. I'm at the National Science Foundation where I work on computer science education. And I'm just wondering, because a lot this work is great and it's work that's clearly needed to be done, but we also know a lot of this information. It's nice to have it all together. What are the next steps? I saw that on the agenda and I kind of want to hear what, whether it's this group or the academies, what's going to happen next to, so that we can move the needle as we know we all need to do.
Well, I can't speak for everyone, obviously, in the room. I can say that in terms of the Dr. Colwell and the Committee on Women in Science, Engineering, and Medicine, this is a topic that will be discussed in our upcoming committee meeting next month. I think that this is a topic we're very interested in. We're trying to work more with some of the societies that are represented in this workshop summary report, as well as other societies. And I think Willie alluded to the fact that there's still some effort trying to work and bring together a more formal volume on this topic. I think the issue of finding places where you can find some of the criteria and some of the ways of having good programs and practice are very important. I think Lisa wants to add something to that. So.
I'd like to add to that those good words. First of all, this isn't a binder. This is a blueprint. and I'd like to point out that this is an international issue. I chair the RIKEN Advisory Committee for the National Laboratories in Japan, and I'm also on several of their national committees, and one of them, in particular, is the Board of Trustees of University of Tokyo. Now, the University of Tokyo has a pretty dismal record, I mean, even worse than American universities, with regard to women full professors and women being recruited to the university. And so I described to the president the advanced program that's being done at the National Science Foundation, and it's been very effective. And I described how it was done. He was very taken with it. The next board meeting, which was a year later, he introduced me to the first class of advanced fellows at the University of Tokyo. So we have an opportunity to have an effect nationally and internationally. So I think that's what this discussion should lead to. And remember, the Y chromosome, don't forget. And I told that to the president as well.
This is Loredana Lanzani from the NSF, the Division of Mathematical Sciences. Just have a technical question. Is it possible to bring back the slide that had the U.S. data on women researchers by sector employment? Might have been maybe the very last, probably after this. That's
yes.
It. Thank you.
Copy of these slides are on our website as well.
Oh, I see.
So just, yeah, we just didn't make copies of them because most of them is, well, all the stuff is in here. It just seemed like to be a little green. You have a copy of this, but we actually have put up a copy of these slides on the website, because we obviously, for the people who are on the web, that's helping them as well.
We should also point out that we saw differences in the participation of women in statistics versus mathematics. We just don't have all that broken out. They're still working on that. So I just want to make clear that it's not just the mathematics part. That was the other part as well.
Bruda? I adore international comparisons and country rankings, and often use the argument, people tend to think that their own country, the status of women in their own country reflects the natural state. And so it's often useful to say, oh, but it's not the same way in another country. But one of the things I discovered, I was at the National Science Foundation and sent to Lithuania, which happens to be my family country, on an embassy program for about 6 weeks. And when I came back, I was very cautious in describing the country as the size of West Virginia. And I think one of the problems with looking at national country rankings is the country as a unit disguises mm-hmm. incredible differences, because some of these countries are the size of Rhode Island. And so you have the you're comparing things that are of a scale, and I don't know what it is. Is it 1 in 100 scale differences between these units on the chart? So you have size, and you have complexity that goes with size. Then you have whether you have a uniform educational system controlled by the government. And let me pick Estonia. I don't know if it is true or not, but you're talking about possibly a uniform educational system where they say require the same courses. And in our system, it's completely, not controlled the same way. So you're comparing environments, educational environments. And then the other huge variable that is hidden in these lists is the state of technological development. And when you compare, if you're from Ghana, you find yourself at the bottom of the list every time. And it would seem to me that if you are going to do more work to start comparing countries of the same size or disaggregate them on that basis, just the same way as we don't like, lumping women and minorities, lumping all the countries on one list, I think we should go beyond that now. So I hope some future work starts to do that.
Actually, to a large extent, that is something, that's a theme that is within the chapters in general, right, is this idea that we really can't, you got to be careful, it's apples and oranges, right? And as well, once you kind of compile the data, that's like half the battle with international comparisons, is being able to compile the data itself. Once you've got that, now you can start looking at applying some more nuanced analyses that do take into account size, such as using D-scores to measure segregation, or shift-share analysis, or a Kitagawa analysis, or something like that, that would help us to be able to control for that. And then as well, we're doing it at a qualitative level, so that the folks who did a chapter on education, we're looking at those kinds of issues, at the extent to which there was standardization or not, and that's part of what makes this such a complex project, right, is that you want to try to understand that rich complexity and not simplify it into, like a set of scores.
So I'm Pinka. I work for Office of Science, Department of Energy. We support a lot of research in physical sciences. Physics is very big for Department of Energy. So I'm curious, this is a clarification question. Why physics is not included as a discipline in this study? So that's one question. Forgive my ignorance. You may have mentioned this, but I kind of missed. Yeah. The second question is that currently, you see a strong focus in your study of siloed disciplines, life science, chemical, computer science, mathematics, and statistics. With such, many of us works in science area, actually scientists, although we work with educational programs. We know that in the scientific and technology world, nowadays interdisciplinary research is a very strong trend, particularly in innovation, in terms of innovation. I mean, because breakthrough usually has been proven, not what I said. Breakthrough came actually at the boundary, occur at the boundary of different scientific fields. So I'm curious how in your future to address the discipline you might have addressed in a way, but it's not clear to me in the presentation you have and in the report. If not, are you planning to address this issue and how you plan to address this? Because I think it's very important. Just give you an example. We have internships, fellowships, particularly students. At the graduate level, they still have these major differences. At the graduate level, you can have a grantee, you know, to get a graduate fellowship. If you read their research description, you will know this student work in biochemistry, biophysics, sometimes biochemistry, physics, sometimes geophysics, biochemistry. I mean, it can involve four or five fields. I mean, you might think students try and get confused, but you really look into their research, it's true. You know, they have all these core components from different disciplines, single discipline, because the problem, the real challenge demands that. It's not up to us. So those fields are not invented. So I'm hoping this could be addressed in the future in some way. So is that clear?
So the why not physics, at the time that we started to put this together and to whittle it down to a few fields to look at, physics had actually had quite a bit of activism at the international level in terms of women's issues. And so from a standpoint of trying to get our hands around it, it looked like physics was well on its way already as a discipline, because the disciplinary society was doing quite a lot. American Physical Society, mm-hmm. American Institute of Physics were both doing quite a bit of work on women in physics. Okay. And so this was the idea was, okay, well, here's some areas where we haven't seen quite as much work. So, but the idea is to, as you say, start, you know, to take the approach and to apply that to other fields as well. Interdisciplinarity, that's, you know, if you got any answers to that, you know what I mean? Because there are some very interesting, there's some very interesting research that folks like Scott Frickle have been doing on interdisciplinarity and looking at trying to understand kind of the contours of these developing disciplines. Mm-hmm. However, to a large extent, if you look at the structure of how people move into the labor market, they still, at least for the time being, are still in specific disciplinary areas through their education, even if they might combine multiple areas, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So looking at how education is organized, and that could change, you know, quite dramatically in the next several years, of course.
Okay.
But mm-hmm. at least up until now, that's been the case. But yeah, definitely that would be an issue for future research.
Yeah, so I guess the clarification I got, message I'm taking away is that the name, the taxonomy you have here is kind of from where they get degree in terms of the major published on their diploma.
It's where the data is collected. I mean, I think you raise a really important issue, and I want to make sure we have time for a few more questions, but I just want to quickly add that we have another committee member, Alice Agagino, who is an NEE member and is a member of the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of California, Berkeley, and she shared with the committee her perspective. If you actually look at the faculty who are in the, I think it's called Physical Sciences, Technology, and Engineering Division mm-hmm. of Berkeley, 2/3 of those who hold joint appointments in more than one department are women. But if you actually look at where the reward structure is, in terms of where grants go, in terms of affiliation, in terms of what publications count, so we have this disconnect. I completely agree with you, where we have a lot of innovation happening at the borders. The problem is there hasn't been a complete discussion about then how do you get the recognition and the reward structures to recognize them. And the other challenge is that particularly seems a lot of women move into those borders, for lack of a better terminology. And I think it's something that the committee recognizes overall.
Okay.
But I would welcome your conversations from the Department of Energy about how you then think through, in terms of your fellowships and in terms of your programs, I know that Berkeley is starting now a program on energy. Well, what fields do you include or not include? So I think that, that's something we acknowledge, and we would love to have everyone's input on that.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, Susan Lavrakis, Aerospace Industries Association. I'm wondering if the committee would be willing to share who you view as your strongest partners internationally, not just in terms of data sharing, but in terms of elevating the issue, the importance of the issue, and advocating for women in these fields.
Well, I guess because we're still actually not only doing the analysis, but we also steadily identifying potential partners. So some of these happen to be, as I think as Dr. Caldwell mentioned earlier about the UN, and so there's our other speaker. We've not taken a narrow approach. What we've tried to do is to identify any groups or organizations that has an interest in this, and not just these three fields. Because I want to make sure that it's clear that the original idea here was not just three fields, and nor was it just OECD members. It was much broader than that, because for some of the developing countries, they are different organizations for women, because they've run into the same kind of problem that the organizations scientifically involve mostly men and not women. And in some populations that are very diverse, the subgroups of women are not dealt with. So one of the things we've looked at would be persons not only just in, not outside of the academic community. So we're asking the communities to let us know who else or what other groups are actually involved so we can partner with them. We don't have the resources, first of all, to do this by ourselves. And that was never the intent. Much of our intent was very much what NSF always says, being catalytic. We wanted someone to start paying attention to these particular issues. But we also want to have some rigor that was involved in data collection. And so a lot of the issues we understand, and we understand that there are different people working on things, but we cannot do all that by ourselves. So any ideas you have that people can take a piece of it, we're glad to pass the piece off. And even the issue that was brought up about innovation, I think our policy people already know that many of the startups of biotech involve women. But sometimes there's a confusion of interdisciplinarity and multidisciplinarity. And finding data to break that out is not an easy task. So I think anything you have to share with us of whom we should be talking to would be helpful.
I'd like to add that I think where the greatest advances have been made are in Scandinavia. I would say that Finland probably has more, in my experience, more women actually involved at the higher levels of academia and in industry. Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. I spent a lot of time there. And the University of Oslo and one of the programs that I'm chair of the advisory committee, I would say half the researchers are genuinely active women. There are countries like Japan, which simply because the country population is aging, and even the young men are not going into science and engineering, and it's a very insular society, and it isn't very, how should I say, interested in immigration. It realizes that it has to turn to women, otherwise it's not going to be competitive. So it's external forces that are driving it. I would suggest, though, it might be useful to analyze the, and that goes back to the question earlier, to analyze the cultural similarities rather than country size, but the cultural factors, and those are pretty powerful.
So to that point, Finland. And it was interesting to see those numbers. So Maria Makarov is the immediate past president of the European Science Foundation, and she's a Finn. And she talks about several years ago, there was a mandatory initiative that the Finnish government put forward that 40% of government officials had to be female. And she said the first 2 years were pure hell. And then they got past that and to Ruta's point. And I just wonder if young women have now, for so many years, seen leaders. They've seen Hillary Clinton's at every turn, not just one that we point to here. And so it's sort of diffused. It's imbued into their culture.
This person's been standing for a while.
Sorry.
So I just have a question about...
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Sorry, my name is Mantha Nagaraja, and I manage the Women at NASA program over at NASA. And my question is, so often, and as Susan also mentioned, we hear that relation that when you educate women, then the economy grows. But some of your data shows opposite. I'm wondering if the panel can provide insight. So you showed a couple of graphs where women in some of these countries that aren't as advanced as Switzerland or the U.S. have larger numbers of women graduating with these degrees. But those economies aren't as strong as Switzerland, for instance. Is it because the women aren't allowed to enter the workforce, or is it, and if that is the reason, is it their choice, or are the countries themselves limiting these women?
Well, you know, that's quite the tangled web. Right? what you see is that there are some countries in which, you know, you've got educational institutions, and they build them, and people come, and there's not necessarily jobs there. In fact, my dear friend Connie McNeely and Jung-An Ham have a very interesting article in Global Studies Review about the disconnect between educational systems and the labor market. You know, and that, you know, sometimes what you get is, you know, oh, we think that if we have all these much more highly educated people, that that'll grow our economy. But once you get, you know, you can ramp up the educational system, you can pump people out in 4 years, right? Well, it might take you a little longer than 4 years to get that economic infrastructure in place for them to have viable jobs. And so what you end up with, and I might not quote it right, Connie, but there's a high rate of unemployment of, Indian engineers, for example. Right, and so, you know, so just because you've got the warm bodies there doesn't necessarily mean that. The issue really is, I think, and I think this kind of gets to what Ruta is saying, is looking at gaps and differences. To what extent are the women who get, say, a degree in mathematics able to get viable, good jobs in the economy versus the men? Right? Is it the case that, you know, you get this level of education and then you've got the opportunities and there's equity within the workplace, or do you hit a brick wall when you get into the workplace? But I think that a project like this gives us lots more questions, and if you're a researcher, job security, for a long time to come.
Hi, I'm Gary White from the National Science Foundation and from the American Institute of Physics. I guess I wanted to ask the question about Asia in general. Dr. Caldwell mentioned Japan in some context, but China, India, other large Asian countries, what is the general picture there and what is the intent of this group in moving forward in that regard?
Well, in terms of the general picture, I mean, there are a lot of different issues. I mean, what's interesting, I know, in China is you've actually seen and I think this echoed a little bit some conversations earlier about access to education, where you've seen actually in China some differences now where women used to be more larger percentage of those getting particular doctoral degrees in physics and engineering fields than they are in China right now. So China is very different than Japan or India in terms of that. In India, it's interesting because you used to have some sex-segregated undergraduate institutions, particularly for women, that were very strong and did quite well. But then all of Lisa's issues raised about access to workforce get raised. I think the group did have colleagues from Asia who worked on this, and we had colleagues from Malaysia and from Japan and from others who worked and looked very much at this. And I think, you know, this our interest right now was to make sure not only do we include those countries, but particularly Latin America and in Africa, which have other developmental issues that we haven't really addressed here in terms of brain drain, or when people actually get their degrees, do they actually have an opportunity, if they do them outside of the country, to come back and work? So as I think Lisa, I'm just going to echo what she said. You know, there are a lot more questions than answers, but we did have a very active group from many Asian countries who are involved in this project, and we hope we'll continue forward.
Maybe I could add a little bit here, because my science envoy responsibility included Vietnam and Malaysia. And by the way, that's a great program. We have to keep it going. Malaysia was very interesting because, just to come back to the point that was raised, you know, what do you do when you've got these trained people and they don't have jobs? Well, Malaysia is in the process of establishing its own National Science Foundation of Malaysia, and an NSF individual has been detailed to help Malaysia set up the National Science Foundation there. Having some former students there, I can say that this will be a very important step forward, because the government is making a very heavy investment in science and engineering and technology, and they're trying to be as open as possible to engage women scientists, but engage, because it's a very mixed society of Malays, Chinese generations, and Indian generations too. They were beginning to suffer a brain drain out, because there was a tendency to essentially provide guaranteed employment to the Malays, which represent really the native Malays, only about 20% of the population. So I think that will be how the country will be advanced. And then Vietnam is a country on the move. Really watch that country, because they are making huge investments in science, engineering, and technology. And again, because they are making that kind of intense investment, they are agnostic about gender, simply because they want to get the best people into the workforce. Singapore is a little different. They're making huge investments, billions of dollars every year, and women scientists are involved at the principal investigator level, but it's still male-dominated and not very receptive yet, but moving along. So I think what's happening in Asia is really quite fascinating. And as Kitty said, and as the report says, it's complex, but it's exciting to see what's happening.
I guess the other issue we ran into was a so-called data quality, and that was an issue. One of our colleagues from Taiwan was working on that country and trying to get data for China as well. And so the question was the reliability of the data and the availability. And you might recall when the Academy here in engineering went through this stuff, about 700,000 being produced, and then we only had 70 here, and then one of our colleagues in sociology at Duke said, wait a minute, there's a quality about the data that you're using. So that's been one other issue, but I think, as we all know, for our group, it was critical to begin to understand what was happening there. And those countries are very diverse, and some of which include subpopulations. It makes a difference for ethnic Chinese in one group versus there are all sorts of other issues. But I think your overall point is well taken. We do need to pay attention to that. But we also felt compelled to pay attention to Latin America as well as the as Africa. And we noticed that within our own backyards in the Caribbean, very little attention has been focused on that.
How many more hands do I see? I think we'll have those who have their hands up, and then we'll, because I want to make sure you guys get back at appropriate time. So if it can be a quick question, please.
Hi, I'm Sarah Miller. I'm a AAAS fellow at the National Science Foundation. Much of the data you showed relates to education. If you could give a single recommendation to a public school superintendent and a college president in this country, what would it be?
I'm hoping that Lisa and Willie will think about this and probably give a more astute response. But I think the interesting thing about this is that it echoes some of the conversations about having role models and having access and expectations. So where you have uniform education standards, where everyone takes algebra, where everyone takes physics, where everyone takes chemistry, I think you can see at least the production. It doesn't address the workforce, but I think what you'll see here, obviously, in the U.S. is we have huge variations by state about what access is expected and what perceptions. I think the second thing that's really interesting in terms of this is that echoing a little bit about what we've talked about is a lack of knowledge of what you can do with some of these degrees. I work also for the National Academy of Engineering, so we see this in engineering. I think you see this in computer science and mathematics in particular, somewhat in chemistry, where there's a lack of understanding by parents and by students the access of career paths and patterns that will be very varied that they can have by getting these technical degrees. And I think maybe other countries make it more straight, or we make it less, you know, there's a lot more options and therefore isn't as clear what those clear paths would be. So that would be my two cents.
Can I just add one?
Absolutely.
I would start with the very early years and insist that every girl and boy have the exact same and high expectations, and that fourth grade be marked as a critical time to make sure that all the girls get over the math and writing and reading issues. So I think we've got tons of data to show that that's where it starts.
Hi, Debbie Hughes with the Business Higher Education Forum. And my question is, going back to the, as we drill deeper into understanding the different disciplines and dispelling just this big monster of STEM education, we start to look and see that each of the disciplines have very different data and very different needs. So programmatically, you start to think about how you could build programs to meet each of those and how the associations affiliated with could get very nuanced, but also could get even more separated and more stovepipe. So I'd like your reactions to how we could sort of build a community of practice where we learn together as the data gets more nuanced.
Well, I think that's actually, you know, the point of this effort, really, is that to, you know, to be able to pull, to look at the fact that, you know, there are some kind of interesting things going on in different disciplines, and then how is it that we can then share that across and do some cross-pollination, right? So the idea is to be able to pull it together, even though we've sort of split it apart, you know what I mean? That's from a standpoint of being able to understand that, and then to say, okay, so if we've got a program in one field in one disciplinary society, to what extent will that work in another?
So my vision to my left wasn't as good as it possibly was. There was a third hand that was raised when I called all last questions. So you actually have the last question.
Great. So I'm Sarah Akbar with Oracle, large software company run by a woman, second largest software company in the world run by a woman. And I work on this issue with World Bank as well. One thing of note, at one point I counted 5 men in this room. Women got the right to vote because men voted for that. When we're trying to solve a problem about women's equity, not having men in the room is not a solution. I don't fault you. I know invitations go out and how it is. It's better than the World Bank. There is 1 to 20 women in the room, so this is better. But, you know, role models do not have to be of the same gender. My role model is a man. His role model was a woman. And just because you have 2% of that in there. And my question was, actually, is where do you guys define parity? Because it's never going to be 50%. We have too many women in biology in this country right now. We don't have enough men. Per Title IX, they're non-compliant. Chemistry, we have more than enough women. Math, we have more than enough women. But physics and computer science and engineering, we don't. And when I talk to deans of universities, those are the hard subjects. Those aren't for girls. Biology is now for girls. Psychology is now for girls. But not the hard sciences, and you'll note the names when you see how they, math is no longer a hard science because there are more girls in it or more women. So where do you guys define parity? And also if you did anything about dropout rates, because we see a lot of anecdotal data of women who go into computer science or physics or engineering and then drop out because of a negative experience with a faculty member, dean, other students.
Well, actually, the data on dropout for engineering is that women are actually more likely than men to persist. Yes, that's been the case since about the 1980s. You make a really good point. You know, what is parity, right? And, you know, I think that when I've had discussions with other people, it's concept of equity, you know, and the idea that, you know, that anybody could look at a field and say, hey, that's something that I might find of interest. And that from the other side of it, that from a student